Nathan Fraser Show, episode number 65. Kevin Geary joins us, and he's going to teach you how to kick ass and take names in today's online business game.
Government is inefficient and should be dissolved.
What government should actually do is just leave people alone to buy and sell freely among themselves. If they just leave self-interested traders to compete with one another, markets are guided to positive outcomes as if by an invisible hand.
It's free markets that are moral because you only succeed if you meet the needs and wants of other people.
One of the hard things for people to understand is that the more you try to control an economy, the more quickly it falls apart.
Capitalism. God's way of determining who is smart and who is poor.
What is up, a free market squad in the place to be? Thank you for taking an hour out of your week to hang with me. And this week, our very special guest, Kevin Geary. And we're going to be just talking all kinds of stuff. If you don't know who Kevin is, he is the owner and CEO of Rebooted Body and very contrarian guy. Very much in line with what the free market squad is all about. He's also a member of my mastermind, and I asked him to come on and discuss health and discuss life, work-life balance and marketing and a bunch of other stuff. You are in for a treat. Before we jump into it, much love to truthfrequencyradio.com, UCY.tv, and LRN.fm. And if you want more of this podcast, NathanFraserShow.com. All right, without any further ado, let's jump into this week's interview. All right, free market squad in the place to be. Kevin Geary is in the house, and Kevin is... I'm just going to flat out say this. You're in our mastermind, and you just every single week floor me with your marketing and business knowledge. And I am completely honored to bring you on the show. Kevin, how you doing today?
Man, I'm doing good. Thank you.
All right. So we're going to cover a lot of stuff, but before we even jump into it, just to let my listeners know who you are and what you do. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into the business that you're in.
Sure. So I'm an entrepreneur at heart. As far back as I can remember, I've been doing entrepreneurial type things, going back to, you know, selling candy in middle school and elementary school, which, you know, by the way, was contraband at that time. But then, you know, getting more toward adulthood, I was very heavy into martial arts. I was doing Olympic Taekwondo at the time and ended up becoming an instructor. Then I became the head coach of that school's competition team. And I started working my way into becoming a co-owner of a new studio location. And I did that successfully. That was back in 2008. So I ran our main location for a couple of years before I did the co-owner thing. But I got my own school in 2008 and ran that for 5 years. And, you know, that was probably my first taste of running a physical location type business. I did a little bit in bartending, kind of simultaneously as a side gig at the time. So I created a mobile bartending service that basically supplied bartenders to weddings and other events and venues and things like that. So, but of course, that wasn't like running a retail location like, you know, martial arts studio is. So kind of had a wide range of experiences doing stuff online and offline. And, you know, the partner that I was working with when I co-owned the martial arts studio just wasn't a great guy. I mean, it was my instructor since I started. But, you know, in terms of doing business with him, it wasn't a great experience. And towards the end of co-owning that studio, I was looking for a new path. I was looking for a way to get out, basically. I also didn't like the direction the martial arts industry, at least for those martial arts, Taekwondo, karate, the very mainstream martial arts. I didn't like where they were headed. They were, all the schools were becoming belt factories. The quality was declining rapidly. And I was trying to fight against that from the inside, but I realized pretty quickly that I had, you know, very little control over it. And so that was another reason why I was looking for a way out. Also, during that time, I was working on transforming my health because I went to the doctor and got a physical, and they said that, hey, you have high blood pressure, you're a borderline diabetic, I was about 60 pounds overweight, and I tell people that I dieted my way up to 220 pounds, that weight that I was at, because I was following a lot of the conventional advice. I was restricting calories heavily. I was over-exercising. And of course, that stuff works until it doesn't work. Like, you can do it for a few months, you lose weight, but then when you come off of it, you fall off the wagon, so to speak, as everybody says, then you gain all of that weight back plus more. And if you repeat that process enough times, you look up after a few years and you're overweight and you have a lot of negative health outcomes. And that's where I was. And I asked the doctor at the time, you know, well, what do you recommend? And he basically told me, eat less and move more, more of the same, you know, just the traditional dieting approach. And of course, doctors, you know, they don't do a lot of research in nutrition at all. They kind of just parrot what, you know, their licensing agencies and stuff tell them. So, you know, I kind of got angry. Like, you know, here I was, he's telling me I have negative health outcomes, but he really has nothing to tell me otherwise. You know, either you're going to make this conventional dieting approach work that doesn't work for anybody. It has a 95% long-term failure rate, or I'm going to put you on medications. So we're going to, you know, give a nod to the pharmaceutical industry, and that's the only options that we have for you. So I set out like looking for people who are saying something different than all of this nonsense that I was hearing. And thankfully, I did come across people who were making sense, talking about, hey, why don't you try just eating real foods again? Why don't you try to, you know, reduce the amount of exercise you're doing and exercise smarter instead of harder? You know, there's more functional type approaches to exercise that you can try. Why don't you start paying attention to sleep? You know, instead of going to bed at 1 a.m. and waking up at 7 a.m., why don't you try going to bed at 10 p.m. and getting more sleep? And here are some ways to improve the quality of your sleep. Why don't you focus on hormones and gut health? And so I started implementing all of this stuff and just got really amazing results, and results that were sticking. And it was like, why? Like, this is information that everybody needs. Why is this? Why does it seem like nobody knows this stuff? And so, you know, it just so happened, because I was running the martial arts studio, that as I was going through that transformation, the parents of my students just saw that. They saw that happen over the course of about a year. And they started asking me, hey, what are you doing? What are you trying? What are you, you know? And I started helping them on the side, and they started getting some decent results without really much direction at all. And I ended up starting a more organized group. I put out an invite to our email list at the studio, and I said, hey, if you are interested in, you know, doing an actual curriculum, I'll put one together based on what I've learned so far, and we'll just go through it together. And I got 16 people, it was eight couples, to agree to doing that. And that kind of became the start of Rebooted Body. I decided to take it online in 2013 because that was the obvious way to scale it. And I saw it as a potential opportunity to get out of the studio that I was running and into something else. And that actually happened rather quickly. So I went online with the website January 2013. In August of 2013, I was making enough money to leave the studio completely. And that's when I told I call him my boss. He was really my co-owner, but the relationship was more of like, you just, you know, kind of do what I tell you to do. So that was it. You know, right before the big back to school rush happened, I was like, eh, I'm out. Sorry. And I left.
So there's a lot to unpack there. I'm going to start with, one thing, and we'll see where the conversation goes, but mentioning the karate studio that you were in and the arrangement that was going on there. And this is something that, dealing with a lot of business owners, I've come across pretty frequently, and I want to get your take on. Mm-hmm. People who have a passion or a really good knowledge about a skill set, but have absolutely no business understanding at all. Was that kind of a situation that you were facing there? And if so, or if not, how important is understanding business to being a business owner, as opposed to just being very good at whatever it is that your business provides?
So it's very important. You're right. And I read way back then, thankfully, I read a book called The E-Myth, which I'm sure you've heard of and probably have talked about on the show before. That's a book I highly recommend to everybody who's thinking about starting a business, because you're right. You can't just be good at something and then start a business around it and everything will work out. Generally, the passion for that thing leads those types of people to just becoming they don't start a business. They start a job. Right. And that wasn't the problem in this case, though. So my co-owner was a good business person. In fact, probably too much. He was the kind of person who stopped caring about the quality. And I mean, this doesn't make you a good, you know, business person, but he was hyper focused on the business side of things, so much so that he didn't care so much about the quality of instruction. He wanted it to become a belt factory because he saw that as the way to generate much more revenue and profit. I didn't. I wanted us to run a sound business, but I wanted us to also have a very high quality product. So both of us were business minded. He just had a different philosophy than I did. And that's where it kind of separated. Of course, he also had a very, very plush lifestyle. So before I came around, he was the sole owner, you know, of that location, very successful location. And his personal lifestyle reflected that, you know, he had very expensive cars, a very big house. He had a lot of stuff to maintain. And when we opened our studio, you know, he was very concerned with adding to that lifestyle and maintaining that lifestyle versus investing in the business and growing the business and giving me what I was worth. So there was a lot of friction there as well. And that's why ultimately, you know, I worked with somebody else as well who was managing the studio that I left when we opened the new location. And he was facing the same issues. He couldn't get paid what he was worth. He couldn't move up. He had no control of the studio because the main focus was on supporting this one owner's lavish lifestyle, and everybody else was suffering underneath that. And, you know, we kind of looked at where this was going and we're like, look, he's never going to want to cut back on what he has. And, you know, the business is not going to go forwards. It's not going to grow because everything's being sucked out to pay for cars and houses and all this other stuff. This is not going to end well for anybody. So we both saw it as like, we're just spinning our wheels here and we need to move on.
So two things. Number one, for the listeners that don't know, a belt factory would be?
A belt factory is basically they bring their kids in and you appease parents by, and you know, the parents are just as responsible for this. They want their kid to be a black belt, right? But martial arts is very difficult, especially for young kids. And it takes a long time to get good at. But schools have found ways to push kids into new belts faster. They cut corners on quality. So when you go to a test, for example, so it's very common in Taekwondo to test for a new belt. And at those tests, you would want to see a very high level quality of technique. And there's form patterns that have to be memorized. And if you make a bunch of mistakes on those forms, ideally you would not be ready for the next belt. When you go to sparring, if you can't adequately demonstrate effectiveness in your techniques against another live human being, partner, and you know, we did Olympic Taekwondo's full contact sparring. So you have to demonstrate effectiveness in your techniques. And if you go to a test and you see, all right, well, here's Johnny and he is testing for the next belt. He's not really looking super effective in his sparring. He made a lot of mistakes on his forms. His techniques aren't quite that sharp. In the old days, Johnny would have failed the test. Johnny would have to work on improving in those areas and then come back and retest and demonstrate that improvement. In a belt factory, everybody passes. Everybody wins. There is no failing. There's everybody that goes to the test, and of course they pay a fee to test. So schools are incentivized to test kids because that's a big portion of the revenue. Everybody passes, everybody gets a new belt, and it just keeps moving on like that. And so the only way to try to maintain quality is to hold kids back from testing. But then if you do that, because you know that if you send them to the test, you know, the owner is going to basically say they passed and let's give them a new belt. So you try to hold them back from testing. If you're like a studio director, you just don't put them on the test list. But then you start getting complaints from parents, and parents are like, wait, I want my kid to have the next bell. Why isn't he testing? And of course, you've published not just techniques that a student needs to know. You've published time frames. So you've set an expectation where, okay, if you're a blue belt, you're going to be a blue belt for 4 to 5 months. Well, that's really the minimum. It's not the – but parents see that as, oh, 4 to 5 months, that needs to happen. You know, it's been 4 to 5 months. It's time for my child to test, right? That's the expectation. And a belt factory would promote everybody at the minimums to get them to black belt as quickly as possible. By the way, the black belt test, you know, there's a fee for every belt. It might be 50, 60 bucks. At our school, it was actually tiered. So every belt you went to next, it was $5 or $10 more expensive than the last test. Makes no sense, right? Black belt would be about a $1,000 test. So again, the schools are incentivized once you're brown to get you to black as quickly as possible. So it's just, you can see it's incentivized strictly for revenue, zero quality. And most of the schools in America are going this route. Almost all of them, in terms of like the taekwondos and the karates, they've all sold out. The only ones left that aren't really selling out are Brazilian jiu-jitsu schools and like maybe some Krav Maga schools and things like that. But taekwondo, karate, most of those schools sold out a long time ago.
So my free market capitalist spider sense is just going off over here because a couple of reasons. Number one, we hear the free market will decide the best product will be the one that stands out. The more superior product will be the one that wins. And the myth of, just like what you said with your boss, the motivations that he had led to, or your co-owner led to a vastly inferior product. Also, the criticism of the public education system where everybody gets a participation trophy. Mm-hmm. Seems like that mindset was also pretty prevalent in the private sector that you were working in. What would you say to, because I know that, maybe I don't know. I know that I am an advocate of free market capitalism. I would assume that you are too. But right there, your personal story kind of leads or lends credence to the skeptics of free market capitalism.
Well, no, I think if you look at trends, so you're right that the market is going to determine what the highest quality thing is, and hopefully at the lowest price. But if you look at how that actually manifests itself, it doesn't happen right away. So let's say there's going to be – a portion of the market goes in one direction. And let's say that's not a great direction to go in, but it's successful for a while. And then people figure it out, and then there's a correction, and everybody abandons that and goes to something else. That's what's going to happen to that aspect of the martial arts industry, and you see it already happening. So if your product is martial arts, your product is quality, your product is self-defense. Can people adequately defend themselves? Yes or no? Are your techniques, if somebody wants to learn martial arts, are the techniques that you are teaching high quality techniques? Do you produce high quality students? And the answer for most of these studios now is no. Now, they're still making a lot of money, but they've shifted into what they actually are providing as a product. So, for example, they've switched more over to telling parents, oh, well, our main product now is discipline. We're going to provide your kids with discipline by shouting at them and having them do push-ups and all of this other stuff, which parents buy into and love for the most part. And that's fine. If you want that to be your product, then make that your product and publish that as your product. But you're not teaching kids how to defend themselves anymore. You're not teaching them high-quality techniques. You're not teaching them that failure is required in order for personal growth. You're not putting them through actual tests. You're just putting on a show. And so when you look at the marketplace and martial arts in general, you have MMA, which is probably one of the fastest growing sports right now. And a lot of people, I think this is going to be the market correction, are going to realize, oh, these traditional martial arts have really sold out and my kid's not actually going to learn anything. Like, yes, it's a daycare, It's I can drop them off and pick them up in an hour or two. And so I get some free time. And yeah, maybe they learn a little bit of discipline or something there. But it's not real discipline. It's just obedience. That's really what they're learning is obedience. Or I can take my child to an MMA school where, by the way, there a lot of times are no ranks at all. And there's no incentive to give belts or anything like that. And they can actually learn something and they can actually become a relevant athlete and they can defend themselves. And you see that MMA schools are growing wildly in popularity. And Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is on the backbone of that because Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu through MMA was proven to be one of the most effective of the traditional martial arts. So you have Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu schools who are still not giving black belts to children, who are making adults even take upwards of 10 years to achieve a black belt. And you don't have to pay for the test. You don't have to pay for the belt. It's not. It's the opposite of a belt factory. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is massively growing because people are no longer taking the traditional martial arts seriously. And when your product is no longer taken seriously in the market, I don't see how you can win. And so I think the correction is happening. It's happening slowly, but I think eventually those traditional martial arts are either going to stop being belt factories or they're going to be phased out. And that's when you're going to see the shift.
Okay. So let's kind of let's take that and pivot back to what you're doing now. The health industry, the diet industry, my entire life has been garbage, and it doesn't seem to be having any kind of market correction.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it takes a long time. I think the problem with the health industry is if you look at the causes of – so we have these obesity epidemics. We have preventable disease epidemics. We have a crumbling healthcare system that's not going to be able to care for everybody. And I think that the biggest problem is the addiction problem with regard to food. So you have a bunch of people who are addicts, basically, in the types of foods that they are eating. It's the standard American diet is all processed, hyper palatable foods and very convenient. People love this stuff, right? But it's destroying their health. We are the first generation that's really had to deal with having a food supply that's almost 80% fake. It's 80% processed and hyperpalatable, and we're just now learning to navigate the waters and seeing the consequences of not really navigating the waters very well. And we have to get to a tipping point where everybody is kind of like, holy crap, okay, this really obesity epidemic is out of control and the preventable disease epidemic is out of control and our healthcare system cannot sustain this. And you start to see shifts. Now, we're already seeing that. Like a decade ago, could you walk into a grocery store and there would be an all organic section? Like a quarter of the store is dedicated to organic products and more healthful products? No, you probably wouldn't have seen that, but you see it today, right? You see Amazon buying Whole Foods. You see a bunch of things happening that are demonstrating a shift in the marketplace. Never before have we had access to the amount of real food products available. You can go into my Kroger that I can walk to right down the street and buy grass-fed beef. That was never possible before. They're partnering with local farmers. That's really never happened before, right? So we can see in the marketplace real effects of the shift happening. It's just a very gigantic ship, and it's very hard to turn around. And let's keep in mind that this isn't a free market. This is a market where the government is subsidizing corn and soy, and they're subsidizing fake sugars, right? That's if real sugar is more expensive to use than the fake sugars, of course, all the food products now are going to contain the fake sugars and not real sugar. And this is happening all over, right? The government has its hand in all of these different sectors, controlling how our food is produced, which foods are produced more than others, and so on and so forth. So we can't sit back and say, well, the market doesn't seem to be correcting itself. Well, it can't. It can't correct itself because it's incentivized not to correct itself. And of course, if the government takes over healthcare, they're going to benefit from the adverse outcomes that everybody is going to experience from having this manipulated food supply.
Yeah, it's strange how so many people will look at the problems in the food industry and in the health industry and misattribute them to greedy capitalists and scream that we need more government regulation and more government control over both industries as a solution to a problem that initially, if you go back to its roots, was started by government interference in the first place.
Yeah, I have a great podcast episode on my show called The Secret History of the USDA. And I would highly recommend that a lot of people go back and see the progression of, and that's just the USDA, basically. There's a bunch of government organizations that have a hand in manipulating our food supply and our health. But if you see the manipulation that's occurred just through the USDA, you can get a really good idea of how that's happening. I'm writing a really strong article right now. I'm actually publishing it on Medium.com instead of my own site. The title is the American Heart Association a terrorist organization? Yes, I'm hoping to grab some eyeballs with the headline. But if you look at the amount of destruction that they have caused in actual health outcomes, they're doing a lot better in terms of being a terrorist organization than a lot of actual terrorist organizations are. And I'm going to make the case in that article. But you see these big, you know, the AHA is basically a lobbyist group. It's a front organization for pharmaceutical companies and big agriculture. All of these, it's not really an organization for human health as it's marketed. And I'm going to try to expose that. And that's really what we have happening here is that capitalism has very little to do with the health and fitness industry and the food industry. It's all corporatism and it's all government and it's all, you know, they're corporatist pimps that are controlling all of this. And I think that's what it's most important for people to understand.
Yeah, we're going to take a break real quick. But before we jump into the break, let people know where they can go and find your podcast at.
Yeah, so anywhere you get a podcast, just type in Rebooted Body and it should come up. It's called the Rebooted Body Podcast. So it'll come up in search and go ahead and subscribe and listen. We go one episode a week. I'm trying to get to a 2-episode-a-week schedule.
All right, sweet. Rebooted Body on your podcast player. Kevin, we'll be right back after this break. Listeners, don't go anywhere.
Free minds, free markets, free people.
All right, Free Market Squad, this is a real quick interruption. It's a commercial break for something that's not really a commercial. I just wanted to let you know about something that I've got planned in the future coming to you from me over at the Free Market Squad website. So the freemarketsquad.com website is kind of going under a little bit of renovation. I'm redirecting some of the content, some of the way that the site is laid out. And anyways, the point of this is I am going to be releasing 2 freebies for you in the very near future. So one of them is going to be things to look out for in your marketing, ways that a lot of people waste money and waste time in their marketing. I'm going to be putting together a little lead magnet, a little freebie. It'll either be an ebook or it'll be a video course or maybe it'll be both, but just ways to not waste money in marketing. There's so many options out there and I see so many people just wasting money and, that it bothers me. So I want to help you avoid doing that. And another thing that I'm going to be putting out is, I'm not exactly sure what the complete, I've got it in my head, but I don't have it completely fleshed out, but it's going to be like a guide to help you get or help you avoid getting ripped off by a copywriter. This bothers me so much. There's so many garbage copywriters out there, people that, failed, couldn't make it as a regular writer. They heard that they could make money copywriting. And so they start trying to promote themselves as a copywriter. It's bullshit. The rules that apply to regular writing do not apply to copywriting. It's 2 different worlds. And people, just because you know how to write, just because you know how to edit, just because you know all the rules for grammatically correct or grammatically. See, I don't know. That's not the point. I'm hella persuasive. And that is the point. And just because you can speak proper English doesn't mean that you can write good copy. In fact, usually the people that are anal retentive about English that try to pass themselves off as copywriters, they are not persuasive at all. And so I'm going to be putting together a little freebie that will teach you how to grade people's copy. It'll also teach you a lot of the insider tricks that maybe I shouldn't be giving away, but I want you to be well informed. I don't want you wasting your money on a bad copywriter or bad copywriting in general. So I'm putting together two little freebies coming very soon. Keep your head or keep your eyes out for that. How to avoid wasting money on bad marketing and how to avoid getting ripped off by a bad copywriter. All right, enough of that. Let's jump back into this week's interview.
Let me ask you something. Haven't you ever been tempted to just break the rules and finally
get back at my big faceless corporate bosses for making me feel so small and insignificant?
Look at this, Marge. $58 and all of it profit. I'm the smartest businessman in the world.
Government can print money, but it's the entrepreneurs who really make the money.
Why don't you guys just make your cars cleaner and nicer and try to be better to your customers so that you can compete with Handycar's popularity in the marketplace?
Shut up and take my money.
All right, Free Market Squad, we are back. We've got Kevin Geary of Rebooted Body on the call with us today. Kevin, thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule. And I'm just going to actually take that and go from there. As an entrepreneur, life can become kind of overwhelming. We've always got blog posts to put out, content to create, customers to deal with, new products to launch, and you are definitely one of the people that is always got all kinds of stuff on your plate, but somehow, and maybe it's because of the business that you're in, somehow you're able to achieve the mythical work-life balance. And I kind of wanted to talk about that. How, for most entrepreneurs that I know, being able to maintain their business, maintain a family, and maintain personal health, trying to balance all three of those things is just a bridge too far. And I don't know anybody that actually accomplishes it other than you. Up until I met you, I thought it was just kind of a myth. So what are some of the secrets that, or maybe mindsets? I'm not sure. What is it that, how is it that you're able to do? I look at you and I'm just amazed. How is it that you're able to achieve this balance, able to accomplish goals in all three areas of your life?
It's not easy. And I actually want to achieve more balance than I already have, even though it seems, you know, in a lot of ways, I have more balance than a lot of people do. But I still want to achieve more, and I'm looking for ways to achieve more. And I still think there's a lot of inefficiency in what I do. But in terms of and just to give people more context, you know, when you go to rebootedbody.com, the entire website pretty much was built by me. So I do all of that work on my own. I do all of the design work right now. I write all the articles. I do all the podcasts, not just recording, but editing and publishing and videos. I do the video editing and publishing and all of that. So you're right. I'm doing a lot of stuff. And the end goal is to not do all of that stuff, right? The end goal is to build out a team who does video editing for me, who does podcast editing for me, who does design work for me, who takes care of the website for me and all of that, right? I just want to be a director of sorts, and I want to be focused completely on the growth of the business and the direction the business is headed, and also, you know, serving our actual clients. And as I accomplish more of that, I'm going to have more on the life balance side of things. But I think right now, how am I able to have the life balance that I have? It comes from working quickly. I write fairly quickly. I type very, very fast. I have been doing websites for, since I was like 12. So, and I've been using, I currently use WordPress as our platform, and I've been using that since the very, very, very early days of WordPress. When I need to create a web page, like a sales page or something like that, I can do it in the time it would take somebody else, you know, a couple days to put something like that together. I can do it in a matter of hours. Because I know exactly what I see in my head, and I have no issue, you know, making that happen inside of WordPress. So time saved in that regard. Because I was heavy into photography for a very long time, I'm very comfortable in graphics programs and video editing programs. So if a conventional entrepreneur doesn't have any experience or background in those areas, try to edit their own videos, try to create their own designs and things like that, they would be, you know, in a quagmire, basically, of just a huge time suck, whereas I can jump in and get that stuff done and published and on to the next thing very, very quickly. And, you know, that's really, I think, where most of the balance comes from. It's just time and money saved. Because you have to remember, yeah, sure, eventually I want to have other people doing this stuff. Right now, not only can I do it quickly, but because I'm doing it, I'm not outlaying a lot of money. And so that money can be spent on other things. So we can go on a vacation, a family vacation together. And because everything I do is location independent, I didn't want any part of this company to be dependent on a schedule or a location. So it's very easy for my family to just pack up and go down to Florida. We love Destin. We love Fort Myers. So we can go to these areas and I can run the business from down there. And a lot of the stuff that I do, article writing, podcast writing, video production, if that stuff doesn't happen for a week, it's not a big problem. You know, most of the traffic to our site comes from older articles that I've published that are doing really well on Google. So, you know, not publishing a new article on any given week has zero bearing on our traffic levels. As long as I'm, you know, the podcast really converts well to clients. So I do like to keep that steady and updated, but it's very easy to podcast on the road with today's technology, you know, so I can go down and I can record a podcast while I'm in Florida and publish it. And then that's a couple hours of my time. And then I go sit on the beach and that part of the organization is done. Our clients have different channels where they can be serviced. I do have Zach, who's on our team, who handles a lot of the client stuff. So that doesn't require me. So really, I mean, a week, 2 weeks of just maybe dropping everything in terms of running the business could happen. And so that provides you, that type of flexibility provides you with a lot of opportunity to find that balance.
Nice. So from there, I kind of want to talk about something that I think is kind of vital to that. And you actually have been an inspiration and kind of like a nudge in my own life with this, which is pricing of products. I see so many people and I'm guilty of this myself, completely screw themselves on the way that they price their product or service. And personal experience, I know that one of the things that you kind of got on to me about when we first started talking was that I was not charging enough for my services. And when I recently opened, like went official, got the tax ID number and all the state permission slips, I had to triple what I was charging and instantly started seeing more customers or more clients and higher quality clients. And I was inspired from a story that you told us in the mastermind. And if you don't want to get into this, I'll completely edit this out of the conversation. But I really wanted our listeners to hear about how you went about dealing with pricing when you first started off with Rebooted Body. What was your pricing mechanism at the time? How did you start out? And what did you learn along the way as far as pricing your service and what you provide?
Yeah, so I think this is a valuable lesson because I made a lot of mistakes too in terms of pricing because I had never sold a product online before, even though I had a bunch of websites. Basically, in the early days of me messing around with trying to do stuff online, and I always had a desire, I always had a goal of building a location independent business. Cause I felt like here we are with the internet. There's an opportunity to make money without having to have a physical location, without having to have a schedule, a job, et cetera. And I just don't see enough people taking advantage of that. Like that sounds amazing to me. Why wouldn't you want to be location independent? I mean, if you're entrepreneurial minded, that seems like the route to go. But I had gone in the early days, you know, it was all about blogging. And then what was the goal of blogging? The goal of blogging was to get a bunch of eyeballs so that you could sell ads. And that's how you would make your money. And I tried that route a few times. And I realized through trying that route, it's extremely inefficient. It's extremely time consuming. You probably have to sell out in a lot of ways unless you really want to take the time just over years develop a really, really strong following. But to do the advertising thing, I mean, I gave up in the early days on a lot of different projects that were geared towards that. And so Rebooted Body was the first time I was actually going to be selling products instead of trying to, you know, sell advertising and just put stuff in front of eyeballs. So I started out really low, you know. And so when I took the curriculum from that original group of 16 people that I created and I put that online, it was, I had no idea what I was doing. I put it online as 6 different stages to the program. And I originally put it up as, okay, you can buy whatever stage you want. Like, it wasn't a process that I'm going to lead people through. It was, here are the stages, which one sounds good to you, you can buy it, right? And that wasn't working very well. So I decided to package it up as an actual program, as a process. But again, I didn't have any buyers. I had a small audience. I was doing the podcast. I was writing some articles. The site was getting some traffic, but I had no idea if people were going to buy this stuff. I didn't do any market research like I should have. Because by the way, I was working full time at a martial arts studio. Like, this was just I had no idea the potential, and I was just doing this as a side gig. I think I remember telling my wife, you know, if we can make $100 a month, you know, it'll pay for our daughter's gymboree classes and some other things, right? And that would be cool. So I ended up pricing at like, it was like $9 a month or something to do. And by the way, it was not per month. It was times 6. So after the 6th stage of this program, you can stop paying, right? So you pay $9 a month for 6 months and then you're done. And that's what we started with, which is horrible. But it's a learning process. And this is a good story because people can realize that you can do it completely wrong and you can still win. As long as you make the adjustments, as long as you learn from the mistakes, you see a mistake, you correct it, you learn from it, and then you move on, you can still win. And so I started getting buyers at night. Like, I remembered a UFC event. I was sitting in a bar watching UFC with my friends and my phone dinged and I looked down and somebody had signed up, $9, right? Cool, awesome. So I started, you know, getting more and more buyers. And I started to realize, all right, it's, you know, I ran a very, you know, get a calculator out and do 9 times and see where you need to get to in order to have something sustainable here. Then compare that to costs and your time and things like that. And you quickly realize this isn't going to work. So I think I went from 9 to 19. And then I went from 19 to 29. And this is over the course of, you know, 6 months, I probably did 6 price increases. So from 29, we went to 39, 39, we went to 49, 49, we went to 59. And I just kept seeing, you know, well, people keep signing up. And people did keep signing up at these higher prices. Now, you do run into issues, and specifically with a podcast too, because I was announcing these prices on the podcast. So I have old episodes where I was saying it's $39 to get in. Like, you can start for $39, right? And then when you get, we got all the way to 6 payments of $139 or $149, I think is what we, you know, ended with. And we were improving the program all along the way and all of that. So it wasn't just increasing the price. We were making the program better and better and better. And we were gaining more authority and we were gaining more testimonials and things like that. But we got all the way up. So you think $9 is where it started. Then we get to 6 payments of $139, massive difference. And people were still signing up. And by the way, we had less, sure, we had less people, we had less numbers, but way more revenue. And so we were doing less work to service people for a lot more money. Now, I think in a way this is okay to do in the very beginning, but I if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't do it that way. Because there are a lot of people who saw those earlier prices and that sets a value in their mind. So my philosophy today is it's better to start high and then come down if you need to come down versus starting low and then taking people up. Because once people see a low number, that's the value they place on the item you're selling. And if you go higher, they balk at that. And they're like, wait a minute, this used to be lower. Why is it higher? I'm not going to pay that. Versus if you come out too high and people are like, yeah, I'm not paying, that's too high, but I see the value there, you start to drop it. They think they're getting some sort of a discount. They're like, well, this used to be, you know, $200. Now it's 150. That's a much better purchase. I'll go for 150, right? So I think that's a better strategy. That's a strategy that I would recommend to people. But the core message is you can totally F it up and still be successful.
Now, let's talk about the quality of customer and the experience that you had with your customers when you were selling the $9 product versus the $100+ product. Did you see any kind of, I think a lot of people would assume, well, if you're charging $100, you're going to get a lot more people wanting their money back. A lot of people are going to say it wasn't worth the $100. Whereas if it's just $9, they're going to be like, oh, that's okay. It was only $9, so I guess I'm not losing out on too much. What was your experience as far as the quality of customers and things like chargebacks and refunds from the low $9 price versus the higher price?
So every time we have raised our prices, it's reduced our refund rate and it's increased our retention rate and our execution rate on people actually taking the information and doing something with it. So I think that's very important for people to understand. When you come in at lower price points, you're going to get price-based shoppers. So when people look at your competition and they say, all right, and this is what price shoppers do. They go to a sales page and they go right to the price. They don't read anything else on the page. They go right to the price. If the price seems suitable to them, they don't even know what they're buying yet. But if it seems suitable just from a number standpoint, then they'll go read the rest of the information and make a purchase decision. Somebody who's interested in getting actual results, who values really high quality products and information, they're going to read about the product first. Then they're going to go check out the price and see if they're able to do it, right? If you come in with low prices, you're going to get those price shoppers, the people who only care about the number. And those people are very, very finicky. They don't execute and they will want their money back after they don't execute, right? They'll blame it on you not getting results, but actually they didn't execute, and then they'll want their money back. And it doesn't matter how low the price is. You'll find these people are – you can have people pay $1,000 for something and say, I loved it. I got so much out of it. I would have actually paid more for it. I'm going to recommend it to everybody I know. Take that same product and sell it to a price shopper for $29. They'll find something to complain about and then they'll ask for their money back. It's just how they are from a mindset and psychology standpoint. So if you don't want to deal with those kinds of people, don't price your products like that. You know, be the leader in the marketplace in terms of your prices. Don't be at the bottom. Don't be in the basement. Don't be trying to attract volume, right? Attract quality buyers. That's my philosophy.
Yeah. And one of the things that, going back to my part-time job as a cake decorator, the bakery that I work for, which it's really strange because in Colorado, you're not supposed to sell cooked, like fully cooked goods for like EBT or food stamps. And I should probably preface this by saying I don't hate poor people. I grew up on food stamps. I grew up poor. I sympathize for people that are poor. But one thing that I've noticed is I do a lot of wedding cakes, and the people that almost 100% of the time when somebody comes back and makes crazy demands for a refund on their wedding cake or their quinceañera cake, when it's just totally unjustified and we end up refunding their money anyways, almost 100% of the time when we go back to charge the money back, it's to an EBT card. And I can't think of a single time where somebody who paid with cash or credit of their own money has ever come back and demanded a refund. So I'm not making a judgment about poor people, but it has been my experience that people that shop based off of price are usually the worst type of customers to deal with.
Yeah, and this is why I don't do trials, and I don't, and I've tested this before, and we've done so. I think back when it was six payments of 59, somewhere around that type of pricing, we were running trials. It was a 14-day $1 trial. So, and the reason you do a $1 trial is to make sure that the person is signing up with a credit card that actually works, right? So that when the 14th day comes, if they haven't canceled, you can actually charge them. So we run a 14-day $1 trial, and instantly the number, the volume of people joining increases, which is great. You start seeing sales come in left and right because everybody is willing to jump on that, and they want to see inside and all of that. The refund rate and the cancellation rate also skyrocket, and you realize this is all this does is cause more work for us in terms of managing new accounts, going back in and refunding people. And you have people who aren't really satisfied because they didn't really plan on executing. They weren't really sold on doing the work. They just wanted to kind of poke around in there and see what you had to offer, maybe steal some of your content and then ask for and people would actually ask for a refund of the dollar, right? So it would be the 13th day. It wasn't like, hey, I don't want to be charged. Just go ahead and cancel. It was, not only do I want to cancel, I want my dollar back. That's the kind of people that you're dealing with when you run specials like this and when you price your products very low.
Yeah, I've heard the saying, you have to have something unique about your offer, but never let that be price, because there's always somebody out there willing to go out of business faster than you.
Exactly.
So let's talk a little bit about, I've got you for another 5, maybe 7 minutes. I want to kind of get into your content development, how your strategy for developing the content. You said you do podcasts, you do blog posts, you're doing some guest posting now. How do you go about picking and choosing what kind of content, and how do you make judgments on what's going to be relevant and attractive to the people that you want coming in and checking out your stuff?
Sure. So very good question. And it's something that everybody has to figure out if they're going to use content marketing, which I think everybody probably should be using content marketing to a large degree. The way that you do content marketing is changing a little bit because there's a big shift towards audio. There's a big shift towards video right now, but the principles are still the same. You have to find the intersection of what people find valuable in terms of information and what people are actually searching for. There's a lot of articles that I can write that would be highly beneficial to people. However, nobody would ever find them because nobody's searching for them. So the first thing is you have to understand who you're writing to. And every time I sit down and write an article for Rebooted Body, I have a very narrow demographic in mind. You know, I'm sitting down to write to typically a woman between the ages of 30 and 45 who's overweight, who's dieted for their entire life, probably the ideal Weight Watchers client, who's probably struggles to some degree with emotional eating and overeating. This is the person that I'm writing that article to every single time I sit down to write. Now I have to think about, all right, what are the challenges that that person faces? And thankfully, I have thousands of them on my email list, and I can just ask them a lot of times. But I also have to then, when I have an idea for an article that's not just going to be of interest to that person, but of value to them, I have to make sure it's something that all the people like them are going to be searching for. When they go on Google to try to solve their problem, what are they actually typing in? So you have to find the intersection between what's interesting, what's valuable, and what's actually being searched for if you want to drive cold traffic with these articles, which you really want to do, because if the articles aren't bringing in readers, they're just going to sit there, or you're going to have to spend time and energy bringing readers to those articles. Why not let the article just do the work of bringing in the eyeballs for you? So that's been my strategy. I have a good idea, then I instantly go on to Google Keyword Planner, or there's a number of other applications that you can use, and you start figuring out what people are searching for relative to that idea. And you might be able to come up with, seven, eight different headlines based on one kind of topic. And you start to look at the numbers of searches. You start to look at the competitiveness. You do some simple search in Google to see, hey, has anybody else written on this topic? How are they ranking? You know, what was their headline? What was their title? So you collect all this information. And this sounds like a lot of work, but when you think about some of the articles that I've written, the article on Naked Juice, right? An article on ketogenic diets. These articles can bring in 600 to 1,000 people a day if you do the right research and you actually hit on one that works versus just writing out of the blue and hoping for the best. That's not a good strategy. So going to do this keyword research is very, very important. Then you write the article. And when you're writing the article, it's geared toward all those three things. Can we make it interesting? Can we make it a little bit valuable? And can we make sure that Google's going to love it too and rank it high? You also have to think about not giving everything away in that article, right? So I write a lot for – I do put more information than most people do in the articles because I want people to know that my free stuff is as good as what other people's paid stuff is. And then if you get my paid stuff, it's really going to drive things home for you. It's really going to drive results. So I put more information than most people do, but I also focus a lot on inspiration and motivation and just connecting with where people are at and the challenges that they face so that they feel understood while they're reading an article. And when I make a call to action within that article, they're more likely to click on it and check out, okay, how do I work with this guy? You know, it's not just, oh, this guy informed me of something, but he actually understands me and understands what I'm struggling with. And I'm actually seeing that all of his articles and his entire site, his entire offering is set up to serve me, you know? So they're more likely to become buyers at that point. So it's an intersection of all of those things.
Nice. Kevin, this has been a fantastic conversation. Just a wealth of knowledge. I am fortunate because I get to have these types of conversations with you every single week. For listeners that aren't in that privileged quote unquote position, where can people go to find out more about what you do?
Yeah, so rebootedbody.com is the home base for everything Rebooted Body. So you'll find the podcast there. You'll find our videos and our articles. You'll find our online academy if you want to dive in and do some work with us. That's where I would recommend that you start. And I'm also going to be doing some stuff for – I'm starting a personal project. And this would be mainly for the people in the health and fitness industry that might be listening, but it's going to be valuable to anybody who's interested in business and marketing. But my personal project at kevinmichaelgeary.com is, and you can link to that in the show notes, I guess, is going to be talking a lot about building Rebooted Body and the marketing efforts and kind of behind the curtains of the business, so to speak. So if you're interested in any of that, you can find that there.
Awesome. Kevin, thank you so much. Free Market Squad, until next time, faith in each other, not in authority. Be your own boss. Hashtag BYO boss. We are out of here. Deuces.
Free minds, free markets, free people.